Welcome back to Techonomics. I'm your host, Jason Middleton. Silicon Valley's one-time startups are now mature, money-making businesses. Let's get in the tech weeds with angel investor and Silicon Valley veteran, Jason Calacanis.
Jason Calacanis, angel investor and the CEO of Inside.com.
Yes, Inside.com. And I watched and read your column and podcast for this week, and you made some predictions, and I want to get into that first, okay?
Sure.
All right, so you teed it up with what recently has been done, and the mergers and acquisition season is upon us, apparently. Summertime. Is that safe to say that summertime seems to be when this action happens?
It's more cyclical based upon how much money the buyers have and how antsy they get with their growth. In other words, if you're Facebook or you're Microsoft or you're Google and you're printing money and you have this, an Apple, and you have this huge amount of cash sitting there and your market cap goes up, the stock price goes up, you can be a lot more acquisitive. You can take a lot more risk. And if your business is showing signs of maybe slowing down, like Google's growth as an advertising network, their primary business is ads, it's over 90% of their revenue. If that starts to slow, and when numbers get big, things slow down, right? They don't double or triple every year when you get to year 10 of a company typically. Then you're looking for growth in other places. And so because there's so many big companies in tech right now, and they've gotten so good at being profitable, Facebook, Google, Apple, Microsoft, Cisco, these companies are printing money. Literally, they have money printing machines.
Right.
And as they start having tens of billions, and in Apple's case, hundreds of billions of dollars, they really are faced with really two choices. Give it back to the shareholders in the form of a dividend or invest it in future growth.
Or stock buybacks.
Stock buybacks is a way of – is essentially a type of dividend because if you lower the number of shares available – then the share price should go up. So it's very similar in a way to just giving people money back, except it's not taxable.
Right. Apple has a lot of its money sitting offshore because
– that's a big issue.
And so if they don't want to onshore, that's where they write the checks.
Yeah. So this is a big issue, repatriating funds overseas. So if you make money in Europe or Asia – and you pay tax in that local government, then if you bring it back to the United States says, hey, we'd like to get some tax dollars from that. And it can be quite punitive, 35-40%. And so companies have said, you know, just leave the money overseas, which is their right to do. There's nothing illegal about doing that. And then if they want to acquire companies overseas, then they can use that money and they never have to pay that tax.
Right.
Which makes total sense. It's completely logical. The thing that's illogical about it is that it works against America. And so hopefully our next president will do a better job than Obama did on this issue, which is to say find some middle ground where Tim Cook feels like bringing $100 billion back and giving the government, let's say, $20
billion. Right.
Because right now it's going to be zero, and it remains zero, and it will remain zero. But if they made it, hey, 15 or 20% tax, you know, the government would get tens of billions of dollars instantly.
Well, Tim Cook also has a legal obligation to shareholders. And so, so repatriating that money is going to hurt the bottom line.
If he said to shareholders, hey, we can buy these assets outside the country, or we can make this amount of interest on it, or we can put it in stock markets and make this kind of return every year, you know, and then it makes more sense. Also, they can do – there's a lot of financial instruments now. The world is very flat. And so it's quite possible to take that money that's overseas and then get a bond in the U.S. and get loans in the U.S. to buy back shares against that money, et cetera, et cetera.
Just to blue sky this, would it be really awful just to put a moratorium on repatriating that money and bringing that capital back into our market?
Yeah, a one-time, you know, lower tax rate could be a fine solution to this, since it has built up over multiple presidencies and multiple cycles that we've been unable to get this money back to the United States. Sure, why not? One time, pay 10%.
Boom.
And we take that money and we pay down our debt, whatever.
Because, I mean, the tech sector and the financial sector on the S&P of all 10, those are the two biggest and most valuable sectors. And it could just grow. And then that has a ripple effect.
Yeah. You know, we're in interesting political times. I know we're here to talk about tech, but tech has become the mitigator of all industries. It is the conduit, you know, for every industry now, whether it's finance or media or government. And so government now has to address these issues in technology, and technology has to work with the government to try to resolve these issues. And we have a very polarized country right now, as you may have noticed.
Yeah, a little bit, yeah.
On social media.
Here and there.
A little bit of screaming going on. It's kind of deafening and annoying. But, you know, hey, listen, the main point is the top six or so companies, which, you know, I would put as Amazon, Google, Apple, Facebook, Microsoft, Cisco, they have $500 billion or so combined. Mm. And their market cap, you put the value of those companies together, is $2.5 trillion. They can buy a lot of stuff with $3 trillion.
Right.
And there's something that I was told very early in my career, which was great companies are bought, good companies are sold.
That's
and
right.
So there's a bunch of good companies right now, the Dropboxes of the world, the Zenefits of the world, the Jawbones of the world. They did a good job. They might have been great at some times. They might be just okay or very good right now. Those are the ones that are probably for sale. But the truly great ones are the ones that I find most interesting because they need to be talked into selling, like Instagram, YouTube, and WhatsApp were talked into selling. There's a group that could be talked into selling, and that's where things get very interesting.
Yeah, and there's a lot of money floating around. It's sloshing out there. You're right.
I use the analogy in my blog post at calacanis.com of a deep stack poker game. So if you ever played deep stack poker, when people have a large amount of chips, their behavior changes. When you have a small amount of chips, you're constrained. You don't take risk. You only play the really good cards, the aces, the kings, the ace king, pocket tens, whatever. Your range of cards you play when short stacked is narrow. The range of hands you play opens up when you have a lot of money in front of you. And so these companies, they could take a lot of risk and it would have no impact. You look at Google bought Motorola and it was a pretty failed acquisition. It probably lost a couple of billion. Microsoft bought Nokia. Nobody remembers, nobody cares because Google also bought YouTube and Android.
Right. Exactly. Yes. Well, let's stay on that theme right there, because then I want to circle back. Let's talk about Facebook's purchase of Instagram last year at $1.1 billion. Now, that's got a high ROI so far, right?
Yeah. I mean, if Instagram was a private company right now, they would be valued around Snapchat's market cap. So
around $22 billion?
Correct. And so that would be the case of a founder selling way too early.
Mm-hmm.
Remember, YouTube was sold for $1.6 billion. Back in the day, I think it was six, maybe seven. Yeah, so when that company would be worth $75 billion right now, independently, $50 to $75 billion in my estimation, based on their revenue. So, it's very difficult for founders to know, and especially first-time founders who maybe are not rich. And you know, when you're a founder who has got paper wealth, and somebody says, "Hey, you know how everybody keeps telling you you're worth $300 million, and you live in a crummy apartment in San Francisco that costs you $4,000 a month." How would you like that $400 million to actually be in your bank account or $300 million? It's a very hard thing to say no. That's why you see what's called secondary transactions, which is investors buying the shares of founders to make them, you know, modestly rich so they stay in the game. So somebody like Evan Spiegel at Snapchat, you can be certain, has sold some shares to some investors and maybe taken $10 million or $20 million or $50 million off the table. We don't know.
Right.
These things occur very privately. And that keeps them in the game longer to go for the IPO, which is really the gold standard.
Is that the fiscal moment everybody shoots for? Or that's what investors shoot for, right? Especially early investors like
everybody
you.
Wants the IPO because IPOing is so hard and it means you have a very sustainable and predictable business. Uh-huh. You do not want to IPO unless you can control the levers on your business. So we're sitting here in a sound studio and you can control the volume. When you can turn a dial and control revenue, that is a magical moment for a business. And there are very few businesses in the world can do it, but Amazon, Google, Facebook, and Apple are some of them. When Apple wants to make money, they release a new iPhone.
That's right.
You know, and anytime they want some more money, they could charge for their operating system upgrade. If Google wants more money, instead of showing two ads, they show three.
Mm-hmm.
And Google literally can dial their revenue to be whatever they want it to be. Same with Facebook.
It's amazing.
Pretty amazing place to be.
Okay, let's stick with advertising for a second, because this week we had a bit of Facebook anti-ad blocking. I'm wondering what your take is on that.
Yeah, it's a game of cat and mouse. If you don't know, in Europe, probably medium single digits, 5, 6, 7, 8% of people are blocking ads. In the United States, it's probably 1, 2, 3% of people. The interesting thing is the people who are blocking ads are not people who would click ads anyway.
Mm-hmm.
The people who click ads largely are being tricked. So there was a study done of Google ads, and some percentage, every time they do the study, they do it pretty regularly, somewhere around a third to half of the people who click on the ads on Google don't know they're clicking on an ad. And you're raising your hand.
It's guilty. Like,
well, I mean, they keep changing their standards. So now they put a little AD and a little chiclet next to the thing, and you type in Amazon, and then you're actually clicking on an Amazon ad above the organic search result. In other words, the ad they learned.
I see.
So advertising has always been a little bit deceptive. The FTC actually is taking some actions and writing some letters saying to people like, hey, let's pump the brakes a little bit here because consumers are definitely being tricked. Then you have on the other side of the coin, consumers being very frustrated that they're seeing Taboola or Outbrain ads, which are the ones that have women in, you know, inappropriately sized swimsuits for the proportions of their bodies.
Right.
And you're at work and you're trying to read a Business Insider story or a Huffington Post story, and all of a sudden you're seeing just tons of bikinis that feel, you know, like they've spent too much time in the dryer. And those things are annoying people. And so people then put on their Chrome browser or their browser an ad blocker that knows there's ads and takes them out. I think that's a virtuous thing for consumers to do because it sends a message that, hey, you've crossed the line.
Right.
And so that's what we're finding is equilibrium. Nobody would ever install these for, say, Google ads because the Google ads are kind of appropriate.
Right.
Nobody looking over your shoulder at work is going to be like, hey, what's going on over here?
Right.
Not safe for work.
They're innocuous.
They're innocuous. And in some cases, they add value. And so what's really happening is consumers are just been abused by advertising.
Yes.
And it's sort of like, you know, some radio stations might play too many ads in an hour and people say, maybe there's another option for me. So you have to be very careful with, we talked about the knobs before, when you push too hard. And Facebook, you know, blocking the blockers is just one step in it. The thing is, these blockers have not been found conclusively to be illegal. So until we have, and I don't think the big companies want to start suing the people making them, because what they'll probably find is that they're not illegal.
Right.
If they could legally kill them, they would have.
Right.
But it might be too dangerous to go against one of these ad blockers and then have
they become codified.
Yeah. Like, oh, this is legal. And you know what? What you do on your computer is your decision. So if you download a web page and remove the ads, that's your decision. Just like it's your decision. It's your right to record a TV show and edit it and play it back to yourself however you want.
Mm-hmm.
What's not legal is for you to rebroadcast it, right?
Yes.
So you can download an NBA game and make your own supercut of Kevin Durant scoring 50 in one of the first five games prediction. And, you know,
a fair prediction.
Pretty fair prediction. When will there be 100 points scored by Klay Thompson, Steph Curry, some combination of two?
Yes.
Klay Thompson, Steph Curry.
That's going to be awesome.
And Kevin Durant. Wow. But you could actually edit that yourself. So, you know, it's a cat and mouse game. What's more important for these big companies to realize is when they're pushing too hard on consumers, just like stealing music. If we were sitting here 10 years ago, it'd be a whole discussion about Napster.
That's right.
And now you can get new music at a reasonable price, either on paid radio or Spotify or Apple Music, or you can buy 99-cent MP3s, you know?
Yeah, right.
Before you could buy, you know, they used to force you to buy the whole album, and then they were like, hey, maybe you can buy singles, and now you can buy singles. All of a sudden, stealing goes down. So
yes.
If people are given a reasonable option, they generally will not steal or, you know, use ad blockers.
Let's circle back to the Snapchat. I've got to get there because you have that one teed up as a possible who's next for acquisition.
I think, you know, there's six companies that I put are the companies that are really worth buying, you know, and obviously these are the companies that are the most loved and they have their own money printing machines. They may not be fully to profitability. They may not be, you know, as robust a business as Facebook, Amazon, or Google, or Apple, but they're so close. And that would be Netflix, Uber, Tesla, Snapchat, Airbnb. And then my wild card in the sixth position that many people may not know, but they will, is Slack. Those are the six that don't want to sell,
right?
Are destined to become multi-hundred billion dollar enterprises, but might be able to be shaken loose by a persuasive Tim Cook, you know, or Satya Nadella at Microsoft, or
a real soft
Larry
landing,
Sergey.
Right? A real soft landing for integration into a value company. So a growth company being subsumed by a value company and everybody wins?
Yeah, I mean, if you look at what happened with WhatsApp, you know, which Facebook bought for close to $20 billion, the founder joined the board of Facebook, and Zuckerberg really had to say, listen, I'm giving you 10% of my company.
Mm-hmm.
This is a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
And people didn't think he would sell, and he did. And then Instagram, he had just raised a bunch of money, and at a $500 million valuation, didn't need to sell, and then he sold. So for companies like Tesla, which don't need to sell,
right,
or Netflix, which don't need to sell, for them to sell, there has to be something extraordinary. And typically that has to do with the opportunity. And the opportunity for Tesla, if they were bought by Apple, which I don't think will happen, but I did think would happen 2 years ago.
Yeah. That was probably their window, wasn't it? Because now
Tesla's a
momentum stock now.
Apple and Google absolutely screwed up. They should have literally offered $40 or $50 billion for Tesla before Elon announced the Model 3.
Mm-hmm.
But once he released the Model 3 and 400,000 or so people pre-ordered,
yeah,
a $10, $12 billion pre-order campaign. I mean, there's never been a $10, $12 billion Kickstarter. The Kickstarters, the largest Kickstarters before that were 10 or 20 million.
Right. Yeah.
We're talking about adding zeros here.
Yes.
And once he had that, then I think he had the escape velocity, as we call it, to get there. And he doesn't need Apple or Google. And they're taking out the risk of the Model 3 and hitting scale is no longer necessary. So they probably missed a window.
I don't know, a teachable moment.
It could be a teachable moment for them. This
ends up being what's called a teachable moment.
I'm with Jason Calacanis, an early investor, a very successful early investor, and one of the best in the world, actually. And I'm going to ask you about escape velocity. What does that phrase mean? I love jargon.
Yeah. So for me, escape velocity means that you have gotten out of the atmosphere as a startup and you're in orbit. You cannot be brought back down to Earth.
Okay.
In other words, you've escaped the gravity that a startup usually faces. And what is the gravity a startup usually faces? It's running out of money, not having customers, and basically failing. Mm-hmm. So the rocket is taking off, and all of a sudden it blows up or goes into the ocean or doesn't make it to space. So if you look at, you know, a company like Facebook, there was a point at which it was very questionable if anybody would advertise in a social network. Didn't felt pretty icky.
I remember that.
To do that. And there was a lot of competition from MySpace and Twitter and other places, and it didn't seem very defensible. And then once they figured out their revenue story and once they hit, you know, 300-400 million users, it was very clear that this had escape velocity, and if it was going to be stopped, it would be stopped over decades, not years or months.
All right, cool.
That's
right.
Escape velocity.
Good. So that way when I need to read your next blog, I'll be able to process that a little bit faster.
Yes.
Let's go back to Snapchat because Instagram wants to be Snapchat because Facebook won't be able to buy Snapchat. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, Zuckerberg is absolutely relentless in trying to kill competitors. He's obsessive and he has zero honor about stealing. So Facebook itself, they stole a lot of the ideas that Friendster had and they just executed on them better. Mm-hmm. You know, he's continually looked at other startups and copied them. In some cases, pixel by pixel. Mm-hmm. And he's got, you know, a very bad reputation for meeting with companies and then stealing their innovations. And
sounds like Steve Jobs a little bit.
A little bit, you know, but
at least
you
know, early
Jobs,
on.
I think, added levels of art and design and beauty. You know, it's one thing to be inspired by.
Yes.
It's another thing to wholesale rip off. Mm-hmm. And the list of things that Facebook has just wholesale ripped off continues to grow. And it's kind of distasteful, and it may at times be actionable. And that's what we see right now. Snapchat came up with an incredible device. It's called a story. If you haven't used it, your kids can show it to you. But basically what it means is you make short 6, 7, 8 second videos, and they all get bunched together, and you just tap your finger on your phone, and you see all your friends' little 7, 8 second cinema verite moments of their life. They go away after 24 hours.
Right. They automatically kill.
They're gone. So what that does is it lowers people's anxiety about making a video of themselves if their hair is not perfect. And Instagram was the place where you took a perfect picture of yourself every week.
Right. You curated that,
and
right?
You did the perfect filter and you cropped it and it was just perfect. So that did really well for celebrities or when you were doing your Hawaiian vacation. But, you know, when you're walking down the block and you're getting your egg and cheese and, you know, it's not super sexy, you know, you wouldn't do it. So Snapchat just made this beautiful documentary of all of your friends' lives. It's very addicting. And that's why you see kids just are more interested in Snapchat than they are in the real world. Facebook understood that Snapchat with ephemeral messaging, sending messages that explode, disappear, and pictures that explode and disappear, was onto something years ago. And they created Poke and a bunch of other little knockoffs. They failed.
Even Zuckerberg called it joke after about a year.
Yeah. So Zuckerberg tried to buy Snapchat for a couple billion. It didn't work out. And then he convinced Kevin Systrom over at Instagram to wholesale knock off Snapchat. And in the new Instagram is a better version of Snapchat.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I don't have a horse in the race. I'm not investors in either of these companies or any of these companies, unfortunately. I wasn't an early investor in any of them either. My bad. But
boy, can't win them all, Jason. Can't win them all.
Can't win them all. And the truth is you only need to win one, as Mark Cuban told me. You just have to be right once. And boy, is that true.
Yeah, he was.
You only have to be right. The Jason Calacanis and Mark Cuban series. But, you know, the interesting thing is I think this might be actionable. They copied it so perfectly and they even called it stories. And Kevin Systrom came out and said, hey, listen, I know this looks like stealing, and we're absolutely stealing. And so the question is, what IP did Snapchat have around this, and do they want to get into a fight with Facebook over it? I am a bit of a conspiracy theorist. I think this is Zuckerberg's way to F with, to frack with Evan Spiegel for not selling. Business is personal. You know, in The Godfather, they say, hey, it's just business, not personal. And then they go and murder everybody for insulting them.
Right.
You kind of get the point. Like, it is personal. Yeah.
There will be blood.
There will be blood. And so I think Zuckerberg is doing this to get inside Evan Spiegel's head, to try to get him to sell. And if he does launch the lawsuit, all it does is draw more attention to Instagram stories.
Right.
And in a Sun Tzu kind of way, it's going to take resources away and take their focus off of Snapchat, of building a better product and competing in the marketplace. So I don't think super highly of Zuckerberg and his approach to business. I think he's hasn't done anything creative or unique in his career, with the exception of the news feed, which was pretty fabulous, and the API inside the news feed was pretty fabulous. Those two I give him credit for. But I just think the stealing is abhorrent. Mm-hmm. I think he's above it. Mm-hmm. And I think he's probably turned into a really good person, you know, from starting out as a bit of a thief and having all those lawsuits pile up and all that settlements. I mean, he screwed over a bunch of his friends in the lawsuits. Mm-hmm. But in Silicon Valley, it doesn't matter. You're not supposed to bring up how people got there.
Right.
All that matters is you got there. So if you stole your way to success, if you stole from your friends, if you had a $20 million fine, none of that matters.
Right.
All that matters is that you became rich.
Yep.
So that is a big lesson for the listeners. If you steal and cheat, copy and screw over your friends and become rich, all is forgiven. And you know what? At the end of the day, he's going to give away all his money to charity. So I think he's a bit of a mensch now. So even if he was a thief at the beginning and continues to steal from other founders, he is going to give all his money away. So kudos to him for that.
All right. Jason, you've launched two new newsletters. Let's talk about what Inside VR and AR is.
Everybody knows what virtual reality is by now. Virtual reality is you put on goggles and you're taken to another world. And it's a fully immersive movie. Think of it like that.
Mm-hmm.
AR, nobody knew about a month ago. Now everybody seems to know, which is Pokemon Go.
Yep.
You look at the real world and you put objects in the real world that aren't actually there. Mm-hmm. In other words, it's like taking some pharmaceutical drugs and that are very popular here in San Francisco. And the world changes. So it's as close to psychedelics and Timothy Leary as you can get. But basically AR, augmented reality, that's could be the bigger play. And that's the big debate right now in our industry. Is VR going to work or is AR going to work? And which one will people use more?
Will this spur activity in the hardware space for head up with augmented reality? Are we going to see better Google Glass versions?
Yeah, I think what you're going to actually see, and it's going to take about 5 years in my estimation, you're going to go to lens crafters or Warby Parker, and the majority of lenses and the majority of glasses will be smart glasses in 8 years, the majority will be smart glasses, I'll say.
Okay.
Which means you buy lenses, they'll have a computer in them of some type, and projected on the glass will be something. So imagine walking down the street, and it puts over a person's head your mutual friends on Facebook or Instagram or Twitter.
Right.
So we're walking down the street, and it turns out we both know a founder, and it just puts, these are the friends you have in common above their head. Or, you know, I am a single person in a city and I decide to put my relationship status as open, like some people do on their social networks, and you have glasses on and you can see that somebody's single.
I could also walk by Starbucks, though, and get an ad served to me if I'm geocached.
Right. And then you'll definitely have ad blockers in your glasses.
Yes, you will. All right.
That's a callback.
You've also launched Inside Security.
Yeah, security is a big one. You know, the Sony hack, the Ashley Madison hack, and now WikiLeaks hacking the DNC's emails. If you write something in email, your privacy is an illusion.
Mm-hmm.
And if you've written anything in email, it will be public knowledge soon.
Right.
So about 10 years ago, I started writing every email and saying to myself, is this an okay blog post?
Right.
Feels like a blog post to me. I'll hit send.
Right.
Even though I'm not hitting publish, right. I consider the send button in Gmail publish.
If you don't want
it, you should too.
If you don't want it in a deposition, then don't write it.
Well, this is what I had to explain to people in my company about 10 years ago and the companies I work with, which is there are certain conversations which are for in-person or on the phone. Anything that has to do with a legal issue, you have to talk about on the phone.
Right.
And I basically enforce this by telling anybody, if you email me anything legal, I'm going to give you one warning inside the company, and the second warning is you're fired.
Okay.
Like, do not talk about any legal issues. So when I was at a publishing company, we'd constantly have bloggers make a mistake and publish a picture they thought was Creative Commons, but somebody uploaded it to Creative Commons, was actually owned by somebody. And then somebody's like, I don't think that this is going to, and then the, you all of a sudden you have five journalists or bloggers talking about fair use. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, guys, gals, you're going to get us in a lot of trouble because you're not lawyers. Mm-hmm. And even if you were lawyers, debating the finer points of fair use is not a good idea.
No, absolutely not. Don't leave a paper trail.
So anyway, security.inside.com, it's free for the first 5,000 people who sign up. I think 4,000 have signed up. After that, it's going to be $300 a year. And it's written by David Schramm, who's a very well-respected journalist in the tech space. And then vr.inside.com is the virtual reality one. So sign up for those newsletters. They're free. And that's my way of trying to solve for the journalism problem we talked about on the show before, which is, hey, we need to figure out a way to make journalism sustainable. I have a solution. Hire one journalist, pay them well, and then let them send the news directly to consumers who really want it.
Right on. We've been talking with Jason Calacanis, a successful early investor and highly productive person. Jason, thanks a lot.
Follow me on Twitter at Jason or Instagram at Jason.
Oh, I wanted that one.
Gotcha.
KGO Jason is mine. Thanks, Jason.
Okay.
That was two Jasons talking about money printing machines. And if you took a drink each time we said that phrase, well, I'm sorry. I'm Jason Middleton, and I was chatting with Jason Calacanis. Coming up after the short break, the economy. Two important reports dropped on Friday. So, how will markets open tomorrow? We have an economist next to help us predict the future. Come on back.